Ah, there's the OG Musonomics theme song. It's kind of like putting on an old broken-in pair of jeans that still fit. Welcome to another flash edition of Musonomics, supported by Luminate. I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt. And our returning guest host is Lynn Gonzalez, partner in entertainment law firm Granders & Desrochers, and somebody who has earned her place on Billboard's Power 100 Top Music Lawyers out this week. Congratulations, Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I'm so excited to be included on the list. It is a very long and robust list, but again, I'm happy to be included, and it's quite the honor. I hear you've got an honor coming your way soon, possibly, right? I hear you're a finalist for the Music Biz Association Music Business Music Educator of the Year Award. Is that right?
That's a mouthful, and that's right.
And you're down to just three finalists, right?
Well, it's me and three others.
Well, that counts. Can I vote for you somewhere? Or?
I wish. You would have to be on the Music Business Association board in order to vote. But if anybody listening to the pod is on the Music Biz board,
You know who you are. Get your vote in. We'll be waiting until May 15th to hear who wins that.
This week, we'll be talking about the RIAA 2023 revenue report just out last week. Also, Shot Tower Capital's report on hypnosis and where it all went wrong. And I don't know how we even have a discussion about the popular music business this week and not talk Beyonce and the release of Cowboy Carter. So we will do that.
Yeehaw.
And Live Nation's new venue opening in Brooklyn.
Great.
But Len, I always start. Why don't you kick it off this time?
Well, the RIA released its annual revenue report for 2023 last week, and it showed that recorded music revenues grew 7.7% since last year, generating $17.1 billion. It's the third straight year of record revenue in the music industry since before Napster. So we're up to 96.8 million users, and about 85% of the revenue that's attributed to this number comes from streaming. That's a percentage that's held steady for the last 4 years.
And is there a problem with that?
Well, I think the concern here is that the revenue mix, or should I say lack thereof, may be an issue. A large bulk of the revenue is simply coming from paid subscription streaming. All of the labels' efforts to license new technologies like AI, the social media platforms, all of these emerging categories, they've not yet become significant sources of revenue. I mean, what do you think it means? Is it about changing consumption habits, or do we just have too many eggs in one basket?
Well, I got to tell you, I look at this and I think, you know, when streaming was growing at a faster rate, nobody was complaining about too much concentration of revenue coming from streaming. Some of the alarmists out there are saying, hey, these new revenue sources are still really tiny and not growing fast enough. And, well, maybe that is the case. But the fact is, we are still now for the third year in a row at about 85% of the revenue in recorded music coming from streaming. And that's pretty good. Maybe there are too many eggs in one basket. But there will be growth coming from some of these new areas like AI and like non-DSP streaming, for example, from the social media companies and the short-form video platforms like, you know, that one from China. But for now, yes, an overwhelming majority of recorded music revenue is, as it has been for the last 3 years, from on-demand streaming.
Yeah, my concern is that the U.S. market for subscriptions already passed 50% of internet users, and less new users are added each year. So the only way we're going to be able to rely on streaming for growth is if we just keep throwing in price increases. You know, everything's getting so expensive. We've got to find more compelling offerings to justify these increases, I think, is my concern.
Yeah, and so some of that may come from some of these other news sources. We expect to see that over the next couple of years. We may be at peak subscription, but according to Shot Tower Capital, it looks like we may be past peak hypnosis.
Yeah, they released a report on Thursday that was not good.
To put hypnosis in perspective, first, let's rewind. Merk Mercuriadis, a former manager of Beyonce and Elton John, among others, who was also the CEO of a company called Sanctuary Group from the mid-90s to 2007, is no shrinking violet, right? Merk is ambitious and aggressive, and in hypnosis, he raised a ton of capital from Blackstone and the Church of England and many others to start buying rights and related royalty streams from mostly songwriters. Hypnosis Songs Fund went public on the London Stock Exchange in 2018. They invested over $2 billion and bought songs from Neil Young and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Shakira, Justin Bieber, and hundreds of others. Streaming at the time was rising tide, and Hypnosis helped catalyze a bull market for music rights. Yet, Hypnosis at the time was criticized for maybe paying a little too much for the music rights that they were acquiring. Anyway, last year, the share price of the publicly traded fund dropped 43%. That's a lot. And then the company's independent valuation firm, Citrin Cooperman, reduced its forecast for the amount of money Hypnosis would receive from its music catalogs, and the company suspended its dividend payments, and it was out of compliance with debt covenants. The publicly listed Songs Fund got a new board of directors toward the end of the year and a new valuation firm, Shot Tower Capital. Shot Tower just issued its report last week.
Ooh, those key findings were a little rough. In short, the portfolio was downgraded 26% and states that projections were aggressive and the analysis was speculative. 75% of their catalog missed their gross forecast by 23%. To say it nicely, the folks at the fund were very optimistic. The due diligence done at the time the catalogs were acquired was sometimes missing key documents and failed to meet the music industry standards. I mean, shockingly, the report revealed that the fund is not adequately structured to track its catalog at a song level. And how can you maximize your catalog without song-by-song data to understand a consumer's behavior?
I'd like to look a little bit more into that issue. I mean, I imagine Hypnosis has been tracking metadata about its song catalogs very closely, but the fact that Shot Tower found that there was a gap in song data, or at least song data compliance relative to industry standards, was a red flag for sure.
Yeah, I mean, beyond that, it's concerning because, like, as we were just discussing, the innovations in the music market haven't really been moving the needle from a financial perspective. So a lot of writers and artists have gotten a lifeline from these sorts of transactions. And so I'm hopeful that this problem is specific to just Hypnosis and that other actors in the space have been more careful and responsible with their assets in this new music market. Otherwise, the market may go away. You know, one of the things the report mentioned was that the fund spent a bunch of money on marketing themselves, and they're definitely seen as a leader in this space. I just hope their missteps don't sour other potential investors. And I'll just say this, you know, my reaction is based on the reports that I saw this week. I don't have any insight into what exactly is happening at Hypnosis, but it doesn't sound great from the reports that have been publicly made available.
Yeah, but I think the market fundamentals are really super strong. And even Hypnosis's own public investors pushed the stock price up 8% after the Shot Tower report was filed. So it looks like investors are more confident now that the Shot Tower report has been filed. But now let's get into the fun stuff. Everybody's talking about Beyonce and Cowboy Carter, which just came out on Friday. Have you had a chance to listen?
Whew, I've had a chance to listen, but I haven't had a chance to digest it all. That is quite the album.
Well, there is so much to talk about here. First, I've got to say, I have not been in the tank with Beyoncé for her whole career, but I certainly paid attention when the two singles dropped during the Super Bowl from this album, Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages. Texas Hold'em shot to number one on the Billboard Country Singles chart of all places. And Beyoncé became the first Black woman to get a number one single on that chart, which includes streaming and downloads and physical sales and airplay.
I haven't gotten it out of my head since then, Larry. It's been stuck in my head since the Super Bowl.
But the song only reached number 33 on the country airplay chart. So a streaming explosion and an uncomfortable relationship, I think, between country radio and Beyoncé. This weekend, the New York Times ran a package of two fantastic stories by Ben Cesario and John Caramonica on what's easily the most important album of the year, so far at least.
You know, you mentioned Ben's story, and it cited a study by Jada Wilson, a Canadian researcher at the University of Ottawa, that found that just 9.87% of all airplay on country stations in the U.S. was songs by women, and just 9.81% was songs by white women. So that, I'm not great at math, but seems to leave 0.06% of those songs by Black women, which seems quite small.
Kind of tells a story there.
Quite small. But iHeart, the largest commercial broadcaster in the U.S., is playing Texas Hold'em on all of its country stations. I mean, hundreds of stations and other formats as well. And Tom Pullman, the chief programmer at iHeart said she's achieving the airplay of 6 formats simultaneously and breaking down barriers, showing that a great artist is bigger than any genre by definition. If there's anyone that can do that, it's Beyoncé. Cara Monica's story was focused more on like the breadth of creativity and cultural impact of the full album, the textures and tricks of country music, and how it's not just an attempt to infiltrate country music, but just a huge political statement by one of the most impactful artists of our time. It's quite the undertaking.
Yeah, Beyoncé released a statement on Instagram a couple of weeks ago that was so thoughtful, and it concluded, quote, "This ain't a country album, it's a Beyoncé album," unquote, and no kidding. This record is massive. It's 27 tracks in 80 minutes, and for me, the first track on the album, American Requiem, is just a masterpiece. She does a Beatles cover of Blackbird, and her Dolly Parton cover of Jolene is just indelible. She collaborates with Miley and Post Malone and others on this record. I'm still unpacking it, but Lynn, you got any favorites?
I do, yeah. I mean, there's something there for everyone. I agree that the Miley collaboration was incredible. I'm still stuck on Texas Hold'em. It was just such a fun track. I really enjoyed Spaghetti. My ears were really impressed when that came on. I like that it highlights the Linda Martell and Shaboozey. I thought that was a nice shout out for the culture. I thought Yaya was an incredible, incredible song. Just so much fun and crosses quite a few genres. I want to give a big shout out to whoever cleared the samples on that record, because those samples and interpolations must have been hard to lock down. That was a lot of work.
That's our pal Deborah Manis-Gardner at DMG Clearances. Clearance agents to the stars.
She is a superhero.
She is.
So speaking of more fun stuff, Larry, I hear you had a life and went to a big opening last week.
Yeah, I did get a night out. And although not a top 5 industry story this week, I went to the reopening of the historic Brooklyn Paramount by Live Nation. Now, this is a magnificent renovation. It's a 2,700 cap general admission venue in the heart of downtown Brooklyn. And you can just feel when you walk in there the history of the place, but also the economic impact on the neighborhood that the venue is going to have on all the businesses in the surrounding area. And it struck me as I was sitting in there that this is the kind of project that you can do when you operate at scale, right? Like, not anybody can do this kind of a renovation.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. I can't wait to see it. It does seem like a direct shot at the King's Theater, what they've been doing down a little deeper in Brooklyn. So I am a little nervous for them and what economic impact it might have in that area.
Yeah, for sure. The King's Theater, also a fantastic renovation and a gorgeous theater that's been operating now for over a decade by Ambassador Theater Group, but probably competing more directly with Brooklyn Steel. Which is an AEG venue. The event itself the other night was really pretty cool. I mean, they had St. Vincent DJing.
That is very cool.
Right. And the next night, Stephen Marley was the official concert that opened the venue. And if you look at their booking policy, they've got Pink Pantherus and Waxahachie and multiple shows with Norah Jones and Sting already on sale, along with about 60 other shows. I was talking to some of the Live Nation people there, and they say that the venue fills a gap in the market between its smaller Manhattan clubs like the Mercury Lounge and Webster Hall and its bigger venues. And they'll be able to better compete with AEG, which owns Brooklyn Steel, and MSG, which, besides Madison Square Garden, they also own the 2,900 cap Beacon Theater uptown. So developing artists will be able to stay in the Live Nation ecosystem from small clubs all the way up to the 5,000 cap Central Park Summer Stage, which they are now booking. And, you know, I mentioned the sense of history that you have, and it is really spectacular. I mean, it's a breathtaking renovation. Building originally opened in 1928. Miles Davis played there. Ella Fitzgerald played there. Buddy Holly played there. I mean, they worked on this for 5 years, and I'm told that it cost them over $50 million. And really, it shows.
A great addition, it sounds like.
That's it for this week. Thanks for joining me, Lynn.
It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller.
And from Granderson Des Rochers, I'm Lynn Gonzalez.
This Musonomics podcast was executive produced by Lars Murray. Technical production by Jax Cantrell and Isaac Gaines.
If you like what you heard, share the episode with a friend and be sure to follow us wherever you get your pods so you don't ever miss an episode. And while you're at it, please give us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really helps. Once again, thanks to Luminate for their support on this episode. If you have a story or a hot tip for us, drop an email to listeners@musonomics.com.
And thank you for listening. See you next time.